Hey, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message Podcast. And this has been a hell of a week in American politics. The wheels have fallen off the Republican Party. And I wrote a big Hillary Clinton piece this week, and nobody read it because nobody cares about anything other than Donald Trump. It is amazing to me that the media and the entire Republican establishment took 6 months to realize that they needed to scrutinize who Donald Trump was. Everybody's been amused by the Trump show and all the debates and stuff. And, you know, they've had their moments. But all throughout, I have been somewhat less amused because I realize, as I think a lot of Republicans are doing now, that this guy could actually be president of the United States. It is just, again, I am flabbergasted. I cannot believe it has taken this long. But I guess better late than never. And I want to rant about something specifically. On the day that Mitt Romney came out and delivered his blast against Donald Trump, Trump gave a 52-minute speech that was telecast live on MSNBC, Fox, and CNN that was absolutely riddled with factual errors, inaccuracies, and mischaracterizations. And they portrayed this speech as simply Trump going after Romney. This is what drives me crazy. This is where I think the press has really dropped the ball. A lot of professional malpractice here. Trump, at this point in time, as he's emerging as the nominee, I think the principal job of the media now has to be to fact check him. And I thought Fox did an exceptional job at the last debate. Megyn Kelly deserves a lot of props for putting up video showing the various contradictions in Trump's statements and the various inaccuracies. The biggest one to me is about Trump University. It's a simple point, but I think it's indicative of the lack of scrutiny that he's gotten. He's been walking around talking about how the Better Business Bureau gave him an A rating and how 98% of the students at the now defunct, bankrupt Trump University loved it. That's just inaccurate. The last rating PolitiFact says was a D-. And the fact that he can stand up there and get the podium on basic cable, that they'll give him 52 minutes of essentially free advertising without reporting in real time that he is not telling the truth, I think those days are gone, and we as the media really need to hold this guy accountable. Because if you kind of look at the PolitiFact ratings and the good journalism that has been done on him, I think it is fair to say that he is one of the most fact-challenged, if not the most fact-challenged candidate a major party has ever produced as a front-runner. With that, let's toggle to the part of the race that people have been talking about a little bit less, but is equally as interesting. Tad Devine is Bernie Sanders' main message man, top strategist, a guy with a 30-year history in Democratic politics, and just a really interesting person. Devine, I first started talking about the Sanders campaign 6-7 months ago when they were in the hole. You could get him anytime you wanted. You could get Bernie anytime you want. You walk up to Bernie on the Hill when he's buying a cup of coffee and talk to him before kind of his peak. Devine always had a theory of the case, as Bernie did, to allow Bernie to be Bernie. Now, after this huge success that they had in New Hampshire and the near upset that they pulled off in Iowa, they have had to change course after Super Tuesday and after Clinton's stunning win in Nevada and blowout win in South Carolina. But what I thought is most interesting about him and most interesting about the Sanders campaign, if Sanders doesn't win, and increasingly statistically it appears unlikely that he will win, what Devine and Sanders seem to have done is to produce a template for how a Democratic candidate could run and energize the base. Clinton people I've spoken with, and I mentioned this in my talk with Tad, have said that their strategy for getting out the youth vote is to get Bernie Sanders on board. I think that falls somewhat short of the mark. And the most interesting part of my conversation with Devine, he said a lot of interesting stuff, but the most interesting part of this podcast is when he talks about his ads, the famous America ad with the Simon and Garfunkel song. What they're really doing is a template for reclaiming American imagery and what the country means. And I think against Donald Trump, if he is the nominee, this is what Hillary Clinton is going to have to do. And of course, a little bit of business, as we do every week. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. And again, if you have any criticism, comments, or guest suggestions, or if you want to come on yourself, gthrush@politico.com, and always read us at politico.com. I think we're doing a really good job this cycle. And without any further ado, here's Tad Devine. So, Tad, you grew up in a housing project, right?
I grew up in South Providence, Rhode Island, in a public housing project that I lived until I lived in until I was seven, and then my family moved a few blocks away, and we lived in a tenement house where I lived until I graduated from college.
What'd you folks do?
My father worked for the city of Providence. He was a sidewalk inspector, and he was actually legally blind. So they used to joke about the blind sidewalk inspector, okay? Believe it or not, it was my father, yeah. My mother, neither one of my parents went to college. My mother, her four children had grown up, went back and got her high school equivalency degree at night. At Central High School in Providence, became a teacher's aide.
Are you kidding? So how deep are the roots in Providence? You're Irish,
we lived
obviously.
There. Yeah, my family had lived there for generations, my mother and father's family, you know. So, you know, that was our home. That's where I grew up.
And you're the first generation who've gone to college.
My brother, who wound up with a PhD, my older brother, first generation. He went to college and I went to college and then on to graduate school. So, yeah. I may have had a cousin or two,
But we're not talking about generations back where you guys kind of drifted down.
No, my parents, neither one of them, went to college. That wasn't available to them. But we had a wonderful life. We lived in what would now be considered poverty, but it didn't feel like poverty, when I was living it. I had a great time and had a great experience. I went to a Catholic school through high school. I had a wonderful education.
I thought you went to James Woods Middle School.
No, that was somebody else. I went to school in my neighborhood, that was a Catholic school, then to a Catholic boys' high school, and I played basketball there, and that's really what opened the door of opportunity for me.
The basketball.
Life. I was a very good basketball player. I was an all-state basketball player.
I had no idea.
I was recruited by about 50 or 60 colleges.
I had no idea.
And then you
had a good set shot.
I had a good jump shot. I was a good jump shooter. And as a result, I got recruited by a lot of schools. And it wound up, fortunately for me, making the right decision, which was to go to Brown University as opposed to the University of Rhode Island. I was either going to, and University of Rhode Island is a wonderful school, but I was either going to go to a basketball school or I was going to go to an academic institution. And I wound up choosing the latter.
So back to the basketball for a second. You're a shooting guard, I would guess.
Yes, I was in those days a tall.
Are you, 6'3"?
6'3", shooting guard.
Were you a very, first of all, did you need a screen or could you make your own shot?
No, I would come off the screen a lot. But we had a very good team when I was in high school. Junior high school, we won the New England Catholic High School Basketball Championship. Okay, so beating schools for a school from Rhode Island to beat the kids from Catholic Memorial in Massachusetts, I mean, that was a big deal. And so we had a very good team. We lost the state championships to a lot of the kids who lived in the same neighborhood I grew up in, the inner city neighborhood I grew up in.
Let's just go back a little bit and talk about the running of this race. In terms of, and again, it gets back to race. It has been, I just did a TikTok with my colleague Annie Carney about how the race thing kind of unlocked the messaging problem that Hillary was having. I still think she has a messaging problem, but it's given her, I think, an easier way to talk about things that she couldn't talk about before. To what extent do you think Bernie, if you were looking back, and I know you're looking prospectively, and we'll have plenty of time to talk about that, but if you're looking back at the race stuff, do you think Bernie could have done a little bit more to have told that story? And you're known as a storyteller. Do you regret that? Do you think he still needs to sort of tell that story?
We absolutely have to tell that story. And, I suppose we could have, put more effort or expense or resources into trying to make sure people in a place like South Carolina, for example, knew it better. But we spent millions of dollars, advertising. We had hundreds of people on the ground. We built a campaign. And I think our view of South Carolina was always, well, the only way we're going to unlock pick that lock is to run the table before we get there and to convince people who are very comfortable with Hillary Clinton, have been with her for a long time, a lot of people who didn't vote for her last time but wanted to vote for her this time, that something was going on much bigger and they had to take a look at it. But going forward, I mean, I think we're going to really aggressively try to tell his story. We think it's a fantastic story when it comes to race relations and his commitment to civil rights and that goes back to his youth.
What do you think, and I spent a lot of time in South Carolina in 08 and a lot of time here. And by the way, it was totally night and day in terms of the way that they viewed the Clinton. Bill Clinton in particular was like a different person this time around. He went nuts last time. what do you think it was? Obviously, she connected. Why do you think he, if you were sort of to diagnose this, and this was a 48% loss here when we all thought it was going to be in the 20s. Why do you think he didn't really connect with those kind of voters?
Well, first, I never thought it was going to be in the 20s. Okay, you know, because I have access to information. You know, so you know, I think we knew, you know, it was going to be a big loss, and that's why we spent most of the week before trying to get votes in other states where we can win. You know, I don't think we've made a mistake. You know, I think it's just going to take some time. I mean, that's kind of the bottom
line. But what is it about
line.
Your candidate? You know this guy really, really well, and you clearly, you know, you feel it that he's got the story to tell. Mm-hmm. What do you think it is as you're looking at this? Why is he having such trouble connecting with this community?
Well, I think in the South, okay, in South Carolina and some of these early Southern states, where we didn't compete nearly as much as we did in South Carolina, I just think they know Hillary Clinton very well. They're very comfortable with her. That is not just something that comes because she's been around for a long time. She was around in Arkansas for a long time. Arkansas is a state. Right. I had this conversation with Bill Clinton once, believe it or not, in 2000, talking about Al Gore. And all, and President Clinton was saying, we're at the, you know, I went and did a briefing about the Electoral College because, he wanted to see me, so obviously I showed up.
And for those people who don't know, that was you've had a number of hats, but delegate counting and Electoral College stuff, that was your bread and butter back in those days.
In 2000, yeah. I met with him, and one thing he said, and it really, you know, and I was thinking of it now in this context with Hillary, he said, because he was from Arkansas and governor of Arkansas for many years, he said, you know, people know me there. They knew me in Louisiana. They knew me in Tennessee. They knew me in states that bordered Arkansas, and there happened to be a lot of them, okay?
Yep.
And so I think that familiarity with her and with President Clinton that extends way back before the presidency. You know, back to the time when she was the first lady and he was the governor of Arkansas, you know, the cultural ties that they established with people, not just, you know, African-American voters, but voters from that region of the country. Okay. I think they're very strong. And we've got this guy from Vermont who, you know, they've been introduced to as a democratic socialist who they've never seen before, you know, and I think that, you know, it's just going to be a while before we make those connections. Now, I believe the connections that he can make and has made with people, you know, Ben Jealous is a good example of this. I just saw him on television a few minutes ago as a surrogate for us. The connections he can make with leaders in the African American community, I think, are intense. You know, Killer Mike, who's been out there on our behalf, is just fantastic. And I think when we make those connections, they're really strong because they understand he's for real and he cares about them.
But here's an observation that some of the Clinton people have made to me, and they've actually sort of seen it as a little bit of a dissonance between, I think I wrote about this last week, a dissonance between kind of what Tad Devine wants as a very smart strategist who's been down this road before, and what Bernie is just kind of naturally, is that Bernie is the Obama relationship. Well, first of all, Bernie made that comment at the BET, about sort of Hillary hugging Obama in order to win black votes. Do you think that was a mistake? People keep bringing that one up to me.
Well, no. I mean, I think the point he was trying to make is a valid one, that Hillary decided that she was going to be very close to President Obama on a lot of issues, and that as a political tactic is a very smart one.
Right.
You know, President Obama's standing, not just in the African-American community, but in the Democratic primary electorate is, you know, outstanding. I mean, it's higher than everyone else.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I think that as a political tactic, that's a smart thing to do. Maybe it could be expressed, you know, in softer language or something like that. But I don't think any, you know, disrespect was meant. I think he understands what she was trying to do. And I think politically it's a smart thing to do.
But I think there is a sense, you know, I covered one of the first jobs that I had was in Birmingham, Alabama. I covered African-American politics. Respect is an extraordinarily important element. And, you know, and it's transmitted in ways that are almost nonverbal.
Sure.
Right. Don't you have a sense that sort of her getting so close to Obama has kind of created a dynamic where he might want to tone it down in terms of his criticism of Obama politically?
Well, listen, Bernie has differences with the president, and they are substantive. Okay, the TPP is a very good example of that. Now, Bernie was out front on it. Hillary came to it late, you know. But those differences were, you know, are going to be something that he talks about. And frankly, for Bernie to succeed, there has to be both a recognition of what has been accomplished in the Obama era, which is to take the country back from the brink of depression, but also a recognition of the reality of our economy today, that wages and income are falling behind. So it's always going to be difficult because there has to be at least implicit criticism of wage growth. But I think the way Bernie has done it is by first always recognizing the accomplishments of the president and the vice president, too, who's part of the story, and then moving to the differences that he has. I mean, the truth is, and I think this is a fair statement, that Hillary Clinton would like to continue on the road that President Obama has laid out, build on. Obamacare is a good example of that. Bernie Sanders has a completely different set of policies, like Medicare for all. Okay, these are it's a very different route that he wants to take the country. Now, he wants to do that and explain that to voters in a way that speaks to the concerns and needs they have in their life. So, and at so the same time, he wants to not be a Republican when it comes to talking about President Obama.
So he is tapping a dissatisfaction among many progressives that Obama didn't go far enough. Is that essentially what the candidate
I don't think it's just limited to progressives. I mean, I think the target in our campaign, really, one of the principal targets are, you know, people who make less than $50,000 a year. I wouldn't characterize that as the, you know, the heart of the progressive vote in Democratic politics in America. So his message, I think, is much broader than one that's targeted to people who perhaps were disappointed that President Obama didn't do enough. You know, my own personal view is President Obama came in, this country was about to go downhill, and he fought everything to get us back on track. You know, and I think that's close to the way Bernie feels. Having said that, Bernie's always been a guy who spoke his mind.
And he's going to do what he's... That's right. Yeah. He's going to say what he's going to say,
He is.
And has there been times in this campaign, like, you don't have to get specific about this particular instance, where you have given him a piece of strategic advice and he was like, I can't do that. I got to do what I got to do.
All the time. Yes. Yeah. No, listen, you know, to think that Bernie is a guy who you sit with and say, well, you know, the poll says this and we're therefore we should, that doesn't work with him. I mean, that's not even part. I mean, we do polling in this campaign, but I can tell you the polling to him is it's not even something he has much interest in.
I just lied. Give me an example of where you gave him a strategic.
Well, I don't want to get into, you know, that kind of conversation with him. But I'll tell you in general, sure, he is a guy who knows what he wants to say and knows what he wants to do.
And how does he express it to you? When you give him a, I mean, does he just kind of walk away from the table and be like, shut up and leave me alone with
this? He doesn't say shut up and leave me alone. He just says, no, you know, I'm not going to do that. Let me tell you why. And, you know, part of this is trying to understand who he is, too, and letting him be the person he is. The reason we've had a lot of success, you know, and I'm not saying we're going to, you know, win, you know, 538 electoral votes, you know, or, you know, but, you know, we've had a lot of success in this campaign, starting from nothing and building to where it is right now, is because we've let someone be authentic to deliver a message that he really feels that's connecting, I think, powerfully with voters. And as long as we stay in that space, that's the most powerful place for us to be.
And so, and you accept the limitations of that as
well. I do.
I mean, you understand that there could be a ceiling on that as well.
Well, possibly, but I also believe that we could change the ceiling, that we can bring new people into the process who otherwise wouldn't be there, and that changes the calculus of politics.
And that's why open primaries are better for you than, say, a Florida situation, which is closed.
Yes. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the more people that can come in, the better for us. And listen, we're fighting against a process that limits participation. So that would be one where it's very restrictive and you know, closed to, for example, Democrats only. We're also fighting, on the other side, real competition. Okay, when you see, for example, when Gary Hart beat Walter Mondale, I worked for Mondale in 84, you know, Ronald Reagan didn't have an opponent in the Republican primary in New Hampshire. And let me tell you, every independent in New Hampshire went to the Democratic primary. So sometimes you have an opportunity for a floodgate to come into a primary process and overwhelm the existing establishment vote. Right now, we have Trump on the other side, pulling a lot of people into that process who otherwise might say, well, listen, I'm going to go and participate in the Democratic side. And, you know, that is a limitation on our ability to vote. Now, if Trump secures the nomination in a couple of weeks, I think the number of people who participate in open primaries on the Democratic side could exponentially increase.
The odds are not in your favor. You know that. You've acknowledged that. If she does win, I've talked to a lot of Clinton. It's funny, man. I say, what is your youth voter strategy? And their answer to me is Bernie Sanders.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they're going to put him on the ticket then. I don't know what that means. But
would he like? Yeah. I mean, would he consider that?
Well, I'm sure, of course, anyone would. Yeah. But I don't think there's any plan for that. And certainly, no one's talking about anything like that. I mean, he wouldn't ever think about a decision like that unless you know it was done in the right way and proper way. But I think their youth strategy is going to have to be to do what we've done. Okay, what Bernie's done really is connect with them. Okay, how do you connect with them? Well, I think the authenticity is a big part of it. I think the program. When he talks about universal public education, college education, okay, this is a big idea. okay? And he is talking about it in historic terms,
right?
You know, and I think that's what motivates people. And to come back and say, well, I don't want Donald Trump's kids to go to school for free, and they shouldn't,
right.
And that's not unfair. Okay, you know, that is a very small way of looking at this big issue,
right.
You know, and I would suggest that if you want to motivate young people, do not diminish issues like that. Make them bigger.
Where else has she done that, I think, in terms of sort of like downsizing a big idea?
Well, I think healthcare is a great example of that, okay? And I understand the back and forth. Listen, they've got a political tactic. They've decided if we're going to talk about healthcare, Medicare for all, you know, single-payer
right.
system for America, then they're going to try to put that into the context of us being against President Obama. That's what they tried to do in New Hampshire.
You think that's obviously a pretty disingenuous strategy?
I think it's totally disingenuous.
Yeah.
I think to say that Bernie Sanders wants to kill Obamacare is absolutely fraudulent.
He voted for it.
Of course. He worked hard to, incorporate certain things into it that have benefited millions of people.
Does that personally piss him off when he heard that argument, like just on a personal
level?
Well,
I think, sure. I think that's upsetting to suggest something that's absolutely untrue, that he wants to kill Obamacare. What he wants to do is have America join the rest of the world providing health care for all as a right.
Does he feel, now you've been through the battles, man. You've been, you know, it's funny. This is, you know. You've been an establishment sort of consultant over the years, right?
I'd say so.
In
yes.
various.
Bernie once told me that I was his link to the establishment, okay? And I said, Bernie, you're a United States Senator. How can that possibly be? He said, no, let me tell you. You know, I mean, and
well,
I.
Well, Ted, if that's the case, he really is screwed.
That's don't, now he is. I'd say that for sure. Sure.
But in terms of like the kind of nothing, we've talked about this before, and you've told me that you don't think she's really done anything completely outside the lines, but, has she done anything outside the lines?
No, listen, the campaigns are tough, and there's a lot of back and forth, and I'm sure that they think some of the things we do, you know, criticizing speaking fees, for example, at Goldman Sachs.
Are you going to stop? Now that a lot of people, I think on the Clinton side, there is a sense, it's going to be a very interesting debate, and I guess this is going to, it's going to air after the debate. Interesting debate because I think she really wants to pull a punch right here.
Well, listen, we'll see what they're going to do. I mean, from the very first debate, and particularly in the last couple, because once it got down to a two-person race, I think our view of the debate has always been, okay, if Hillary wants to talk about her message, Bernie will talk about his message,
right.
And there'll be an exchange of dueling messages. Okay, if Hillary is going to come at Bernie on healthcare, on guns, on a variety of other issues where she may believe she has an advantage, he's not going to sit there and take it.
Right.
Okay, he's going to turn around and he's going to come back and he's going to talk to her about things
right.
like speaker's fees from Goldman Sachs. Okay, and if you really look at those debates and you analyze them, you will see he has never been the guy punching, but he refuses not to counterpunch. Okay?
But you've run ads, and you want him to talk about the Goldman Sachs speaking
mm-hmm.
fees. You think it's a central?
I do.
Think that's a central character.
Sure,
argument,
I don't
right?
listen. I don't think. I mean, I've always.
And he's going to continue doing it. Right?
Yeah. I think he will. Listen, I wanted him to talk about the speaking fees because I believe they were a big issue. I thought we should put them on the table up front. And frankly, until the Goldman Sachs $5 billion fine. Became public, and that was right before we did that debate when he first talked about it.
Yeah.
I don't know if he was really ready to talk about that issue, but when he saw that settlement, the $5 billion settlement
DOJ.
Of Goldman Sachs, I mean, I just think that was the straw that broke the camel's
back. So that
back
was
with
what, and what's kind of what's the timetable on that again?
That was right before, I think it was about the third debate.
So when you brought the Goldman Sachs, how early did you bring the Goldman Sachs argument to him?
Before the first debate we talked
and
about.
And what did he
things.
Say to you?
He was like, he was reluctant to introduce an issue like that. It's just so negative, and he wanted to talk about his message and his issues, and that was his posture. And I think,
but the Goldman thing really tore
him. I think it really was upsetting to him that here were these guys getting away with it again. You know, they pay fines and you got kids, getting busted for smoking a joint and they're going to jail. Okay. And it just was too much for him. And I think he just said, you know what, I'm going to talk about this right now. And he did.
But you think, has it been the most effective? It seems to me personally to be the most effective argument against her so far.
Well, I think it's a powerful argument against her without a doubt. And I think it did have impact.
Do you personally think, and do you think, I guess I could separate it between you and him.
Mm-hmm.
Do you personally think That she is how do I put this in a way that's more subtle, but I won't that she's bought and paid for by Wall Street. I mean, do you think that she truly is somebody who is beholden to these interests?
Listen, I think I have a lot of respect for Hillary Clinton. I think she's a person of integrity. I think she has decided, and you know, the people around her, that the system is the system, and they have to navigate it the way it is. Okay, that's I don't think that reflects on them as being, you know, corrupt people. Okay,
right.
This is a legal system. This, you know, and Bernie's argument is that it is the system that is corrupt, okay? And so he has never attacked her, nor would I, you know, in terms of her integrity for doing something that is
legal.
Which
is why it's a little oblique, like off.
But neither are we going to walk away from the facts of what is holding a rigged economy in America in place today. Okay, he believes that, and I think he's right.
And so we're not going to, so we're not entering a new phase of the campaign in terms of him softening that message.
No, I think there are other issues where there are big differences. He's talking about trade right now, for example, and will be,
right,
not just in Michigan, but in places like Ohio and Illinois and elsewhere. And I think the differences they have on trade are profound. Listen, I'll tell you another story.
Yeah.
You know, okay, we all know NAFTA. You know, there's a public difference. We all know permanent normal trade relations with China. There's a big difference. TPP, Hillary, you know, of late came to opposition of the TPP. And I remember earlier in this year, it was about the time of the fast track vote in the Senate, and I was actually having dinner with Bernie. And we were talking about it. And he said, just, you know, routinely, I mean, we're discussing the fast track vote. And he said, you know, if she joined me, I think we could stop this. And he really believed that. And you know what? And I believe it, too. If she had joined him, okay? And by the way, she understands, and they all understand, that the fast-track vote on the TPP was the vote that was going to either allow it to survive or kill it. And, you know, and I think, you know, they waited, and then she came out, and, you know, politically, she is technically now opposed to it, or at least the only public statement I've ever heard from her was, I think, in the interview with Judy Woodruff, which she says, as of today, I am opposed to it. Okay.
Well, listen, there are people, by the way, there are people who are, I don't want to sort of give it away, but I mean, there are people who are close to her who feel that he has been constructive in terms of pulling her.
Well, listen, I believe that. I know it's hard to say that when you're involved in a back and forth campaign where you're trying to beat her, you know, in primaries and caucuses. But I also believe that if she wants to win, and if she is the nominee of the Democratic Party, the way we win is not the politics of the 90s. Okay, it is not a politics of, you know, trying to find an issue like welfare reform and run on it, or have a sister soldier moment. Okay, this is not how we win today. The way we win is by energizing a progressive majority that exists in America, okay? And it's not just a fact of demographics. It's the fact that a lot of people understand that there are failed policies that the Republicans have promoted, and if we can convince them we will pursue different policies, they'll be energized and they will vote.
Do you feel like she gets it?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think she's very smart, obviously, and has been around politics for a long time. And I know President Clinton is, I've talked to him a lot, but on the occasions that I've had the opportunity to speak with him about electoral politics in America, I find him to be absolutely, utterly brilliant, you know, in his understanding of the way.
Even now.
Well, I haven't talked to him in a long time. But, you know, I mean, the last time I mean, he was a tour de force when we talked about, for example, electoral college targeting.
And, he gets it,
and,
yeah.
You know, in 2004 he was out of action a little bit in the general election when he had that heart issue. But then he came back, and he really, I think, has an understanding of the way, you know, our electoral politics work in America and the way elections are won.
But you're talking
in America
about something visceral that the Obama folks and you understood. You know, we were talking about the youth vote, you were talking about specific issues. I don't think it's specific issues. I think it's the aspiration, and I think it's also, and I think it's the fact that it isn't granular necessarily. It's a general sense of where you want the country to go,
sure,
and then the policy sort of follows that.
I don't disagree with that.
That's been a real struggle for her.
But when I say issues, when you talk about universal college education, to me that is aspirational.
Do you feel like that? Do you feel like that? Because you did mention that first. I mean, do you feel like that for him has been the key that picked that lock?
I think it's been really important in getting the attention of young people, because what it says to them is, listen, I understand that a lot of you are walking around with a burden of debt on your shoulders that is holding back your future, and I want to do something about it. Yeah, I think it connects with them.
Somebody else from your neck of the woods, Elizabeth Warren, it seems to me like she has an enormous amount of leverage. I think probably my calculation in a crass political way is that her leverage would probably decrease as his, if the progression that we saw on Super Tuesday continues. How useful would it be to have an Elizabeth Warren endorsement?
It'd be fantastic. I mean, but, you know, no one has put anybody like her or anyone else, and Bernie in particular, on the spot about our view.
Have you guys asked?
I don't believe so, that he has talked to her in that way. I don't know for a fact about their own, right, you know, conversations. But I know in general this, and this has been our strategy, that we believed if we were going to win support from, you know, superdelegates and a lot of the Democratic establishment, it was not going to be up front. It was going to be later in the process. That first we had to win support from voters, and we had to demonstrate to the superdelegates and the party leaders that Bernie would be the best candidate. He'd be the strongest candidate. And that was – that was a back-end challenge for us, not a front-end challenge, winning that kind of support.
Michigan – we have this coming up. You've said to me it's a linchpin. You've said to other people too. He's trailing pretty badly, and I haven't seen sort of a progression in the polls. What are your feelings about Michigan, and why do you think it seems like such an uphill climb at this point?
Well, I think I believe Hillary has a substantial horse race lead in Michigan, but I also believe, and I think, you know, I'm informed on this, that Bernie has made tremendous progress with voters there. He's got great favorability. He's got almost no unfavorability. He has advantage when it comes to important issues, and he has the potential to move at the end, you know, and while we are behind, we've been behind everywhere.
Right.
I mean, in all those states that we
won last
Tuesday.
Massachusetts was a little different.
Our first poll in Massachusetts, we were 23 points behind.
But I mean, like in the last six, since
well,
New
got
Hampshire,
closer.
Really
sure,
did.
We got a bounce out of New Hampshire, Massachusetts. Yeah. We got closer in Massachusetts, but there was never really a public poll that I saw, and certainly in our own polling, right, where we were ahead. We were always behind.
Right.
But what we've been doing in every single state, and by the way, this goes back to Iowa. I went back a couple of weeks ago to review all the early polling to think about how we were going to close up some of these Super Tuesday states with media. And when I went back and looked at the Iowa polling from end of December, early January, because, you know, everything happens so fast, you forget. You know, what happened a month ago seems like a year ago. And when I looked at the, you know, our first poll in January in Iowa, we were down 15 points.
Wow.
Okay. And at the same time in New Hampshire, we were up 15 points. But remember, we won by 22. So you know, we moved New Hampshire 7 in January, in the beginning of February. We moved Iowa 15.
Oh, you could in Iowa, you could feel that thing coming.
I think everywhere where we've done well, we've had a lot of movement at the end. And I think that's just characteristic for
Bernie.
But
we have a different trend line in the past couple of weeks. I mean, she really, I was surprised as hell. You may not have been by the South Carolina stuff. They were really surprised by the South Carolina stuff. Yeah. And they were more surprised by Nevada.
We fought hard in Nevada, and we were trying to win. And we thought we had a shot, too. And I think we were hoping the turnout would be bigger. You know, we thought we could get more votes, and we didn't. You know,
Why do you think? What's the wall you hit?
Well, I don't know that we, you know, I wouldn't describe it as hitting a wall. I just think, you know, we could have done a better job, you know, on the ground, IDing and pulling out vote. Okay, we gave it a good effort. I think I could have done a better job on my side of the campaign, persuading people with message. I think it's harder in a caucus than it is in a primary, right, where people are going to turn out and where the message side is more than the organization side. But I think, you know, we should have, you know, maybe we could have done a couple of things differently. She had great institutional support. Support in Nevada.
And culinary not endorsing was a big, big deal, right?
Yeah. I mean, we were trying to avoid, you know, the most powerful organization on the ground there being conspicuously for our opponent. I think in the end, they got a lot of support, you know, from that quarter, you know. But that's just the way it goes. But I wish we could have, you know, found another 20,000 people to turn out in Nevada. That would have been, because I think then we, and the same is true in Iowa. I mean, it was just a small fraction that we lost by in Iowa. I mean, we were trying to win Iowa and New Hampshire, Nevada. That was our strategy. That's what we tried to do.
And then you had to reassess. Yeah.
And then after Nevada, when it, you know, we understood that we hadn't done that, and then the reassessment was this, that we said, okay, we're going to make a long race of this. We're going to pick our spots on Super Tuesday. We picked five of them. We won four of them.
Right.
You know, we're picking some spots in the next couple of weeks. And then we'll start to move at the end of this month into places like Washington State, Wisconsin.
We're inherently
strong. We've got a big
strong
showdown, I think, in New York, where hopefully we'll have the resources to run a big campaign.
You keep talking about New York.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, are you going to basically be able to outspend her in almost any one of these?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, first of all, let's remember this. And by the way, this is very, I would like to point more media scrutiny in this direction.
Yeah.
They are spending millions millions and millions of dollars through super PACs right now against us. Okay, that's happening out there. So when you say,
priorities,
are you going to outspend? Yeah, priorities.
3.5 million.
Million. It's a huge amount of money that's being spent, not just by priorities, but by other super PACs as well. They've got all kinds of money being going right from Wall Street, right out to the Democratic primary process.
Just name the super PACs we're talking about.
Well, I think, you know, I can't even remember the names of all of them, but it's, you know, it's priorities is spending the most.
Right.
You know, they're on radio. They've got organizational activities going on in the street in places like Detroit. Okay, right. They've got a lot of stuff going on, and it's millions and millions of dollars right now.
You think
now.
It's coming straight from what? You think it's straight
sure.
from sort of?
Absolutely. Listen, they raised $25 million last quarter. $15 million of it was from Wall Street. Okay, it's a matter of public record, and their expenditures are a matter of public record. So this can be traced openly. Okay,
so this is not a
secret.
This is the plutocrats strike back.
Well, yeah. No, I think we got their attention without a doubt, and I think they're anteing up. So when you say, "Can you outspend her? Can we outspend all the super PACs and the campaign?" I don't think we can, but can we be competitive? Yes, we absolutely are competitive.
Okay, back to New York. How the hell are you in New York?
Well, I think, you know, we got a guy who grew up in Brooklyn. Okay. Great neighborhood there. You know,
I heard she was a Yankees fan.
Yeah, right? Well, I'm sure, you know, but, you know, I think we tell his story. I think we try to connect with voters. And by the way, we heard a lot in New Hampshire about being a neighbor. Well, he's a neighbor in New York, too. Okay,
right.
Vermont, and actually that Burlington Media Market pours a lot more into New York, upstate New York, than it did into
absolutely.
New Hampshire.
Sure.
You know, so
right across Lake
Champlain. Yeah, so I think, you know, we'll make a run at it. And again, she'll have all the institutional
and you
support.
Feel holding her, but also holding her close. A couple more questions, I'll let you go.
Sure.
The Michigan.
Right.
If you guys lose Michigan and lose it convincingly, is that a cause for a new reassessment, or is it just motoring on down the
road?
No,
we've made our reassessment. Okay, our reassessment was after we didn't win the first three, which we tried to, we were going to have a long run. Okay, that's all. We went from a sprint to a marathon. I mean, that's the reassessment. Now, where are we going to target our efforts? Well, we'll target them in places where we think we can do well and win.
Okay, but as the delegate math starts, I hate to do this to you, but
sure.
You know, this is the reality of these campaigns. As the as you move further up the road, and I know California is looming on the horizon, you're totally right about the Northwest, Wisconsin too, but as the delegate math starts to become more inexorable and she starts piling up the superdelegates, that's going to be a huge deal.
Well,
do you have to, at that point in time, you know, clearly you have leverage in terms of the way you're sort of changing her platform. You already have. At some point in time, do you then start thinking more seriously about how can we have an impact on what she means as a candidate?
Well, this is the way I think we're going to think about it. There's pledged delegates and there's unpledged delegates, the so-called superdelegates. We're going to try to beat her in pledged delegates. We think we've got till the end of the process to do that. We think it's going to be hard. It's going to be tough. We know we have to win to get it done, but we think we can. Now, we're not going to know the answer to that really until, I'd say, maybe the middle of April, okay, not the middle of March. You know, we'll see where we are then to make that decision. If it looks like we can do that, to me, this race feels a lot more like 84, okay, and even like 80, which were the first two races I worked on, then 08. You know, I think the
Clinton, when you say 80, are you talking the Kennedy side?
Yeah, I'm talking the Kennedy. I worked for Carter. I later got to work for Kennedy, you know, against Romney. So that was, I worked for both of them. But I saw it from the Carter perspective, and I lived it from the Mondale perspective. But, you know, I think we're hard. Okay, and I think, you know, the reason I say it feels more like 80 and 84 is I think the Clinton campaign perspective, I mean, they're a little younger than I am, okay, that is 08. Okay, it's delegate arithmetic, it's piling up, that's the way it works. My perspective is dynamic, win, lose, the way Hart pushed back Mondale, the way the race kept going all the way to the end. And I think we can get into that space. We have to have big victories along the way. We have to convince people that he's a stronger candidate. And if we do that, I think we can then begin to work on the superdelegate piece later. Remember, people forget this. Over 120 superdelegates in 08 who publicly endorsed Hillary Clinton. Sure. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is a good example.
Before you go, I one of the things I want to talk to you about is apart from the electoral aspect of this, I think in terms of the benchmark you guys are setting for your advertising is on a different planet, okay?
Well, thank you. Yeah, we're trying hard. We got a great team of people, by the way. And I want to say something. You know, I get a lot of credit because I'm the front guy for this, but this has really been a tremendous team effort. My partners, Julia Mulvey, Mark Longabaugh, the people who work for us, there were dozens, you know, involved in this effort, have just been so great. And we could have never made ads like this for what I would call, you know, now that I'm anti-establishment, a corporate campaign.
Well,
okay?
One of the things I noticed about, I want to talk about two ads in particular. the America ad, for those folks who don't know about it, it's Simon and Garfunkel ad. The thing I really noticed about this, and tell me, am I just picking this up or was this intentional? It's not. All these ads are not Bernie ads. They're people ads. Yeah. And you really only see Bernie at the end of that ad. And he's acknowledging the crowd. He kind of walks up through the crowd. It's a progression of him sort of coming up from the people. Was that the intention?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and that ad evolved over time. We spent a long time editing and making it. A lot of people contributed to the creation of it. But as
whose idea was it originally?
Well, it's, you know, whose idea was it? It wasn't just like an idea. Basically what happened was, when we were making the first ad, the bio ad,
yep,
you know, which begins at the Statue of Liberty, okay, and we've always thought, gee, you know, it's important for us to talk about America and his American values through all of this advertising. We had talked about using a Simon and Garfunkel, actually it was Paul Simon's song, called American Tune.
Of course.
You know, and
because it has a Statue of Liberty imagery.
Yeah, and we listened to it.
My soul rose unexpectedly.
Yeah, the Statue of Liberty.
And so it
didn't quite fit, didn't quite work. And then as, you know, so this is a discussion going. And my
one
and
of who's my. Who's the Simon and Garfunkel fan? Did it just kind
that
of.
That was Longaba's idea, Mark Longaba. So then, you know, and so you talk about this stuff. And it just so happens one of my partners, Julia Mulvey, is married to a pollster, Margie O'Mara. So Julia and Margie were talking about the ads. And Margie said, well, what about America? You know, America's a good, you know. And so we listened to America with the bio ad, but it didn't work. It just didn't fit, didn't feel right, wasn't the right music track for it. Fast forward a couple of months, and Bernie calls me up and says, I just had lunch with Paul Simon. And, you know, small world, right? And so he said, and Paul said, suggested we use one of his songs. Not America, a different song.
Which
okay.
one?
Well, I don't want to say because I might want to use it for something else, okay? To be honest with you. But then I thought, well, what the hell?
Graceland.
You know, no, I said, if he's going to let us use one of his songs, maybe we could use America for something. So we had hired an editor to work in-house with us because it's so expensive, this editing. And we have a film crew from Revolution Media, the digital firm that follows him around all the time. And instead of going into a studio and paying a lot of money to cull through all of this film, this massive amount of film, we said, well, we'll hire somebody, it'll cost a lot less, we've got some editing equipment here that she can use, and we'll have her go. So that's when we said, well, you know, why don't we take a look at America and start cutting some stuff to it. So we did that in-house, and then I had put together something that was like a, you know, 60-second spot, but I had a piece in it with Bernie from a town hall meeting that we had filmed in New Hampshire, and basically it was inviting people to join the process. It was all this stuff at the beginning and all the people, and then Bernie comes in, he says, why don't you join it? So I showed it to the campaign and to Jeff Weaver and to, you know, Jane Sanders. Okay. Yep. And Jane said, gee, I really love this, but when Bernie comes in, it seems, you know, it loses a lot of altitude, you know? And so, you know, when he started talking. So, and she was right.
So this was like, this is perfect until Bernie shows up.
Well, it was kind of, yeah. I mean, it sounds bad, but she meant it in a very good way. And by the way, she was, when I first showed her like a rough cut of this, she was the one most, she said, that's the ad. That's the ad. When we showed it to Bernie, Bernie was like, I love this ad. So we took the part of him talking out and then just decided, let's make it bigger and bigger and bigger. All people. And then it came together.
Well, you remember Hillary's first web ad that she did during the campaign was not her. And I thought that was like the most effective thing that she had done for the whole campaign.
I think they've done a lot of excellent ads, and I think that was one of the best.
Let's talk about the Florida one. It's a five-minute, essentially a documentary.
Sure, about the Immokalee workers.
Right, talking about fruit and vegetable pickers and the struggle that they face, Mexican immigrants.
Right.
Very powerful ad. Running in Florida. So I also want you to talk about this in the context. Florida's not a state that you're probably going.
Let me just talk about where that's running, because this is really what's different, and it gets back to Bernie again. And I said before, we could have never made ads like this in most campaigns.
Right.
When we started this campaign, and I was talking to Bernie about the advertising, he really challenged me. He said, "Listen, you have to get out of the box that you're in." He and I have a lot of, you know, conversations of I'm a Washington, you know, and I gotta do things differently, you know, and I appreciate that. And he challenged me. He said, "Listen, you have to do things differently.
Yeah,
we have to be different if we're gonna win. And you just can't approach this the way you normally approach advertising for a political campaign." And so I felt, you know, that was a real challenge that we had to look at things differently. So with this ad that we've just released, you know, and we're gonna do something very different. We have actually negotiated with Univision a 5-minute national buy Thursday, from at 8:48 p.m. Okay, right. And for 5 minutes, we're going to have in the heart of prime time at a network that reaches 4 or 5 Hispanics in America.
Four out of five
in America. Okay,
4 or 5
in 90 markets across the country. We are going to have a national broadcast of an ad. Now, this I believe is a very powerful story. Okay, it's a story about workers in a place who are being left out and left behind. Bernie Sanders finds out about them when he happens to be down in Florida at one of these, some congressional meeting or
in
something.
In 2009?
This was in 2008 or so.
Yeah.
And by the way, this is characteristic of Bernie. You know, he's done a lot of trips. You know, he'd go to Israel, for example, and then instead of going to the, you know, the pool at the King right. David or something, he takes the afternoon and visits a refugee camp,
yep.
okay? I mean, that's what he does. And so in this case, he went and saw these workers. He found out about them. He found out about their plight. He got very interested in it. He came back. Senator Kennedy was the chairman of the committee then. Teddy being the greatest politician, by the way, right. I ever met in my life. Unbelievable the way he dealt with politics. He said, okay, Bernie, why don't you chair this hearing we're going to have? You know, so then they have the hearing and Bernie chairs the hearing. He helps out. They, you know, find him as someone who is their ally and who cares about
very
them.
Very similar, kind of a modern version of what Cesar Chavez was doing in California.
Yeah,
the great pickers.
And now we have a story to tell. It's an authentic story. It's an emotional story. It's a story that people will remember, I think. And what we've done that is different is we're going to go out on national television, and it's almost like a mini novella here that we got for 5 minutes. We're going to tell people this story in every market. And in addition to broadcasting...
There's a moment. I watched it with my 12-year-old son. And there's a moment in it where you see this sort of like battered American flag flying over like the trailers where these folks live,
right.
That really just totally nails you.
yeah. You know, listen, we have tried throughout this process to make it very clear to voters that Bernie Sanders is uniquely part of the American experience. You know, we know what we're up against, particularly if he succeeds in this right. process against the Republicans. They're going to try to characterize him, as they did with President Obama, as someone who's not American, who's not part of our culture and our tradition. And we... You know, if you look at our advertising, the America ad is a good example of it, just the name of it. But also, if you look at the imagery of it, it begins with a barn in Iowa with an American flag painted on
the
side.
To me, it's an update of the Reagan imagery in its own way.
You know, you want to know something it is, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
Because they don't own the American flag, okay, these guys. You know, they can put it on their lapel and they can do what they want on it. This is our country, okay? And, you know, I know Bernie, a son of an immigrant who came here and who made a life, you know, in this country, and his father and his mother, you know, both of them, you know, really believed and loved in this country. We're not giving the America
to the Republicans. So you're reappropriating that imagery.
You better believe it, you know.
Well, with all the Obama stuff with the frickin' lapel pin last time.
I think what Bernie said in the most recent, you know, town hall meeting was, you know what, my father, you know, came to this country, was an immigrant here. No one's ever asked for my birth certificate, okay? You know, we want to know why, because of the color of my skin, and he pointed to his hand. You know, I mean, I think we understand the nature of the attacks that are likely to be launched against him in a general election if he's the Democratic nominee, we're happy to take them on.
Do you think on the Jewishness?
Well, listen, I have no doubt that it will seep into the lowest pores of American politics if we have a fight with Donald Trump or the rest of them.
Do you think Trump is, I'll just throw this out here, do you think, considering his flirtation with the white supremacist stuff, there seems like we just reported the Republican Jewish groups are sort of souring on him. Do you think there's a strain of anti-Semitism in this stuff?
Well, I'm not going to, you know, launch on that, but I have no doubt that if Bernie is the Democratic nominee for president, what we'll see from the other side, the Republican side, will be the worst strains of American politics. I have no doubt about that at all.
The one last question is, does Bernie Sanders still run?
You know, I haven't seen him run in a long time, but he walks a lot. I will tell you that. He's a big walker.
He eats horribly, right? I've heard, like, this guy.
I wouldn't say he, you know, I don't know if we're referring to his diet or the restaurants that he goes to.
I'm a Jew from the same neighborhood.
Bernie is not a haute cuisine kind of guy. I will tell you that.
What's his favorite?
He's very happy. Most of the time he wants to go to, like, a kind of an Asian, Thai, Chinese, Mexican restaurant. So I would say spicy hot food is his favorite.
Well, that's good. On that spicy hot note, Ted, thanks for stopping by.
Okay, thank you, Glenn.